Can you check my voice? Very good. So let's get started. Good morning, everyone. My name is Stevan Vidić. I work for the Windows Azure product team. I spent about a year and a half working as product planner focused on Windows Azure security compliance. I now work in Windows Azure marketing, but I also work very closely on security compliance. So over the past 2 years, I've spent really a lot of time with our customers and partners talking about security and learning, you know, what the most critical objections are to cloud adoption that fall in this category. So the way I envisioned this session is really a different session. I really haven't given this talk before publicly. So what I wanted to do is tell you, take a peek under the covers of Windows Azure and tell you how we essentially operate, how we designed Azure, how we run it, how we operate it, kind of tell you things that are really not being public. Some of the information for this talk is in our security audits, and those are available to customers under a non-disclosure agreement. But all of this, a lot of the stuff really isn't even in the audit report, so I'll tell you more about what's going on with Azure under the covers. And I hope also to hear from you, you know, what your experience is, and specifically if you've heard from your customers about what the blockers are for Azure adoption that are related to security or privacy or compliance. Maybe we'll have some time towards the end to talk about that. So let me ask you a question, if I may. How many of you know that there is a Windows Azure Trust Center out there or have been to the Trust Center to see the content? Okay, thank you. So I set up, let me just show you this site really quickly. By the way, there's a lot of booming echo in the room. I hope you can hear me well. So this is the site that I encourage all our customers to go to if they want to learn about Windows Azure security, privacy, and compliance. The three main pillars are well understood by most of our customers. And so this landing page has a bit about you know, what the site is about, and also an important section on shared responsibility, and I'll cover that in a moment. On the security page, you'll find our cloud control matrix response, so really a star submission to the Cloud Security Alliance that many customers are using to compare various offerings from different cloud providers, how they stack up against the cloud control matrix. Then there's a section that talks about penetration testing. If you want to initiate pen testing of your own application in Azure, what you need to do and how to get approval for that. And I'll talk more about that. And then there's a lengthy list of resources that are focused on Windows Azure security, white papers and MSDN articles and so forth that you can read. On the privacy section, we talk about the contractual commitments we make to customers about the location of data, so where data remains, where you put it, and what provisions we have in place for access to data. We also have a link to a Windows Azure privacy policy. And then down at the bottom, we talk about some specific provisions we have for our European customers and also customers globally, worldwide, in terms of contractual commitments about safeguarding of customer data in our data processing agreement, and also in the EU model clauses. And then we go into you know, more detail about what we consider customer data. So to you, customer data may only be the content that you put into Windows Azure, but to us, it's information in the logs, it's directory data in Active Directory, all of the things that we consider personal data as well. So all that is very important to safeguard. There is also a compliance section on the site that talks about, there's a white paper that Trustworthy Computing authored that talks about our approach to cloud transparency. And then we talk about certifications and attestations that we have for Windows Azure. And we're very transparent on this site. I will tell you exactly what is in scope, which Azure features are in scope for which compliance programs. And you can go and get our certificate publicly available, download it, look at the scope. You can also request a variety of audit reports, so you'll find information that We'll share with you our ISO statement of applicability. We'll show you all of our ISO controls under NDA. We'll give you our SOC 1 and very soon SOC 2 audit reports and so forth. There's a section at the bottom on the HIPAA, which is a healthcare law in the US. And I'll be updating this page very shortly to kind of cover some of the new developments. On the FAQ section, I cover some of the most common questions about what happens if the US government requests data. What do we do in that scenario? Do we just give it, or do we have a process that we need to follow? And I'll be also updating this page later this week, and I'll put some downloadable content to talk about the Patriot Act and talk about the FISA, so the new regulations, which are kind of very controversial, especially in Europe, so I'll talk more about that. We also have a section about audits. So the reason why we go through these audits by independent companies is because we cannot scale in accommodating customer-initiated one-off audits. So instead of we hire someone like Deloitte or British Standards Institution, and they do the audit, and then we provide the resulting audit report to all of our customers, as opposed to engaging with every customer individually. So that's about the trust center. So if there's one thing to remember from this session, it's this page. Go to this page and check out the content. I'd like to tell you about Windows Azure Security under the covers, but I really don't want to start in February 2010 when Windows Azure became commercially available, because it would be really unfair relative to the investments we've made in online services security over the past two decades. So we started in 1989 when we opened our first data center, and then our investments in online security date all the way back to the very first online services we were running, such as MSN and Hotmail. And then we started our own in the late 1990s. We started our own security response center, and then released some of the well-known security technologies, such as Windows Update and Windows Active Directory. A pivotal moment was an internal memo by Bill Gates in 2002 that started our Trustworthy Computing Initiative. And as a result of that, we now have three Trustworthy Computing Security Centers: the original Security Response Center, the Security Engineering Center, and the Malware Protection Center. In the early 2000s, all of Microsoft Online Services standardized on the Global Foundation Services infrastructure. GFS, or Global Foundation Services, is a business unit of Microsoft that manages all of our data centers. They support more than 200 of our online services, including Office 365, Windows Azure, Bing, Xbox, Dynamics CRM Online, Hotmail, and so forth. And then in 2010, in February, Windows Azure was launched. So when I speak with customers, I find invariably that security and privacy, or security and compliance, are the biggest blockers to cloud adoption. But our journey in this space isn't 3 years old. It is quite a bit longer, more than like two decades old. So let me cover briefly. I don't really want to spend too much time, but there are important benefits that Windows Azure realizes from these trustworthy computing security centers. You probably all know about the security development lifecycle that the Security Engineering Center is responsible for. So it's a set of tools and processes that Microsoft uses to produce inherently safer and better software, software that has fewer vulnerabilities and software with less severe vulnerabilities. SDL is required for all of Microsoft engineering, including Windows Azure engineering. So the entire process is applied in Windows Azure, so starting with design phase, where we do threat assessment and threat modeling, then in the coding phase, where we require all of the Windows Azure engineering teams to use the best practices and coding standards, including the use of tools for testing, et cetera, before that code can actually be authorized and deployed to production. The Security Response Center, you may know this business unit by their alias secure@microsoft.com. They are the business division that is responsible for investigation, remediation, analysis of all security vulnerabilities in Microsoft's products and services. They respond to about 100,000 reports every year, about 300 every day. So they're on 24/7. Microsoft has a very mature security incident management process. I get oftentimes asked by customers to explain, so what happens in case of a security incident or a breach? What do we do and what process we have in place and how do we notify customers that there was a breach involving their data and so forth? So within the Global Foundation Services team, also known as Online Services Security Compliance, there is a mature 24/7 staffed security incident management team, and they have a process to follow, including alerting customers and following up with customers, conducting forensic investigations and so forth. There is also a team that you may not know about that is called Global Criminal Compliance Team, and that team is responsible for working with law enforcement worldwide on investigations into criminal activity involving Microsoft products and services. They have legal agents in many countries. They train law enforcement on proper detection and mitigation techniques. There is also a team, how many of you have heard that Microsoft has a team called Digital Crimes Unit? Or DCU. So Digital Crimes Unit is the team that's responsible for taking down some of the biggest botnets in the world. The most recent botnet takedown was the Roostock botnet. This is a team of security specialists and lawyers that they go after attacks on Microsoft platform that are launched many times by organized crime. And so they work closely with law enforcement worldwide. They work with U.S. Marshals Service when they need to go in and seize servers and physical evidence from hosts that are implicated in this activity. And so the Roostock botnet takedown was very significant because that was by far the most prolific and most dangerous botnet that ever existed. It was responsible for about 40 to 60% of worldwide global spam, about 30 billion spam emails every day. And those were all kinds of hooks, phishing attacks for, you know, Microsoft fake lottery scams, you know, fake pharmaceuticals and so forth. Also capable of launching truly massive denial of service attacks on our customers. And so once the DCU team identified the command and control structure of that botnet, they went after, seized the evidence, shut it down, worked in parallel in Europe and also in the US. And what was really interesting, after they were done with that investigation, they dismantled the command and control structure, but they pointed all of the incoming traffic from about more than a million infected PCs worldwide into their own sink located in our labs that have very tremendous bandwidth. And so they were then able to capture all of the incoming traffic from these infected PCs and very much to tell you, based on the IP address, which machine is infected. When you do antivirus scanning or different types of analysis to deduce whether the machine is infected, it's not always easy to figure that out. But if that machine is attempting to communicate with the sync that we now run, well, you can rest assured that it is infected and chances are has other Trojan and other viruses on it. So tremendous success for that team. The Malware Protection Center publishes twice a year a security intelligence report, and this botnet description you'll find in one of their reports. They're the business unit with labs globally, worldwide, that does world-class anti-malware research, and Windows Azure benefits from the telemetry that they have in place. So when vulnerabilities are detected or when there are known exploits, then we work very closely with that team to find out the remedy. They're also actively involved in antivirus or anti-malware work that goes into the Windows Azure platform as well. So I mentioned Global Foundation Services. They are the guys that support Windows Azure infrastructure. They have truly top-notch operations globally. They support, as I mentioned, a lot more than Windows Azure. But in terms of how they prove their good work is through a very long list of compliance programs. So these guys have ISO 27001, they have SOC 1, 2, and 3 attestations. They've received a FISMA moderate authorization to operate back in 2010. They meet HIPAA and HITECH Act obligations. They are PCI DSS validated, so the underlying infrastructure that powers Windows Azure, meaning data center networks, physical access, does have PCI DSS validation for the payment card industry data security standard. So, you know, truly remarkable operation, and we benefit tremendously from the good work that they do, because in every one of our audits, we inherit controls that pertain to physical security from GFS. So let's talk a bit more about Windows Azure Security. This is a slide that I typically show to talk about the concept of shared responsibility. So when you run everything on premises, then you are entirely responsible for maintaining all of the layers in the stack, all the way from networking, all the way to the applications. When you move to infrastructure as a service, then the vendor, the cloud vendor that offers you the service, assumes responsibility for certain parts of the stack up to the Hyper-V layer, up to the virtualization layer, and then you, the customer, are responsible for the base operating system, including patching and managing that virtual machine image, as well as middleware runtime, and then obviously apps and data. In the platform as a service model, the cloud vendor assumes even more responsibility. So the only things responsible that are customers' responsibility are apps and data. And then in the software as a service model, the vendor assumes pretty much responsibility for everything. So software as a service would be a finished service like Office 365. Windows Azure plays in this infrastructure as a service space. So to give an example of a relational database, if you were to provision a SQL Server database in a virtual machine, then you would be responsible for patching and maintaining that virtual machine, you know, also figuring out the hardware requirements or the size of the VM that you need for the SQL Server database. So you've got a full-featured SQL Server database with logging, integrated authentication, all of that, but you do assume a lot of responsibility. If you use Windows Azure SQL database, then when you go into the Azure management portal and you provision that database, then you get three instances, primary and two secondary. You don't have to worry about uptime or backup. You don't have to worry about maintaining the virtual machine or the base image in which that SQL database service runs, and so forth. So this is an important concept, and when we talk with customers about security, it is surprising how often it is misunderstood what's really needed, you know, in terms of shared responsibility. So this is the approach that I'm going to take when discussing Windows Azure Security. I'm going to go through each of the layers in this defense in depth approach, and for each one of these areas, I'm going to show one slide, and on each slide, I'm going to capture the most common questions, the most common objections, misunderstandings from customers about Azure Security. And there is a page, you'll get these slides, there is a page you can go to. It's called 10 Things to Know About Azure Security. So, you know, one thing to remember from this entire session, in addition to Trust Center, would be perhaps to go to this page and read on the 10 Things to Know About Azure Security. So let's talk about the physical layer. As I mentioned, that's provided by Global Foundation Services. So what's interesting is that when you go into a data center managed by GFS, which I very much encourage you to do, then you get to witness firsthand what kind of controls they have in place and how they manage the facilities. So they have perimeter fencing and video surveillance, they have locked cages with hardware behind them. They have two-factor authentication for access into server rooms. They have continuous monitoring 24/7. What I keep finding out when I present to customers in Redmond, we have executive briefing center in Redmond, I tend to have a very different discussion with customers who have gone to Dublin or Chicago or Singapore or other locations where we offer these tours. They are just, these customers are just more comfortable with Windows Azure than customers who have not seen the physical infrastructure where Azure runs. It's important to note that there is no way to access Azure, to get into Windows Azure from on-premises, from the physical location. You cannot get into the fabric and, you know, administer Windows Azure from those facilities. All of the Azure administration is done remotely from our network operations center in Redmond, from our NOC in Redmond. So being on site does not mean you get to see Azure in action. You can do a tour of our NOC if you wanted to see that. But nonetheless, you get to see the infrastructure. And it's actually quite fancy in terms of alarms they have in place, fire smoke detection. Also, the type of deficiencies they have in the latest Gen 4 design is really remarkable. So very, very highly recommended. So let's talk about Azure security. So I'm going to start with the network layer. So Windows Azure is isolated from Microsoft CorpNet. It is on a separate domain. It's not possible to get into the Windows Azure domain simply by virtue of being on Microsoft CorpNet and being authenticated by our Active Directory. When we designed Windows Azure, we had to make an assumption that customers will go to Windows Azure with the intent of launching malicious attacks on the platform or launching malicious attacks on other tenants. So we had to segment Windows Azure to prevent these types of attacks. And so the way we do that is through virtual LANs or VLANs. There are three VLANs in Windows Azure. The main VLAN, which has the untrusted customer virtual machines or customer nodes. There's also the Fabric Controller VLAN, and there's also the Devices VLAN. It is not possible from the main VLAN to initiate communication through Fabric Controller. The way we prevent that is there are Fabric agents that are deployed into virtual machines on the customer side, and they're designed to only accept SSL-protected incoming traffic from the Fabric Controller. They can only respond to those requests. They cannot initiate any communication on their own. And we also built what I called host boundary protection into Windows Azure. Our host boundary protection is comprised of the IP packet filters in the hypervisor and the root VM on every node. And also, it's comprised of Windows Azure firewalls, which are in place on every virtual machine, both guest and OS, both guest and host virtual machines. I'll talk more about that on the host slide. But the packet filtering that we enforce on all traffic originating from the virtual machines is what prevents spoofing attacks on the platform, is what prevents the VMs from communicating with protected infrastructure devices or receiving traffic not intended for them or sending or receiving inappropriate broadcast traffic. It is also possible for customers to deploy other third-party intrusion protection or web application firewalls that they choose. I'll talk more about that on another slide. And that's oftentimes a question from customers. They come from a traditional on-premises environment with ring-fenced infrastructure, with hardware NIDs and a DMZ, and they go into Azure, and then in Azure you have a very different infrastructure. It's all virtualized. We rely on this concept of VLAN segmentation, and it takes some adjustment, takes some time for customers to actually realize that you can build a very safe and well-designed application Windows Azure. And this whole approach that we have with vulnerability scanning and pen testing is very helpful to make customers more comfortable. So Windows Azure has active denial of service or distributed denial of service or DDoS protection in place. You'll find that just about everything in Windows Azure is custom-built proprietary built-in software for Windows Azure. When we talk about DDoS protection, it's a huge issue because once you go to Windows Azure, you don't have all the options that perhaps are in place today from your ISP or from your own on-prem infrastructure to guard yourself against denial of service attacks. So what we do in Windows Azure, we do standard DDoS mitigation techniques such as SYN cookies. We also do rate limiters and connection limits. But we also have dedicated third-party DDoS systems in place that work in combination with Windows Azure software load balancers to sanitize incoming TCP and UDP traffic and mitigate DDoS and attacks, kind of protect the platform from DDoS attacks automatically. We are working with multiple vendors. We currently have Arbor TMS devices in place, but we're looking at other options as well, including some of our own and so forth. But it is an area of ongoing investigation. Windows Azure also monitors internal initiated DDoS attacks and will remove offending VMs from the network. So these internally launched attacks are easier to mitigate, first of all, because of the anti-spoofing capabilities built into the platform, and also because of the fact that the Fabric controller will make sure that all of the virtual machines deployed into the Azure Fabric will get the resources they paid for. So it's not possible for a, you know, infected or other compromised virtual machine to consume unlimited resources and starve its neighbors or affect other virtual machines. So let's talk a little bit about, I'll talk more about what you as a customer can do to protect your own application. You do benefit from the DDoS protection at a platform level as a tenant, but there are other options available to you to use if you happen to be targeted specifically. And some of the attacks, DDoS is kind of a broad general attack. The most common is a SYN flood, but customers are oftentimes more concerned about specific targeted attacks at their own application, especially customers in certain regulated industries. Windows Azure does penetration testing internally by our own teams on a continuous basis. We also hire independent third-party firms to do pen testing of the platform services. So as part of our FISMA, ongoing FISMA audit, we essentially had to have a government auditor do pen testing of the platform, and we also hire another firm to do the pen testing on a regular basis. We do not publish or make these pen test results available to customers. However, what we did was we retained also another independent third-party firm called NCC Group to do pen testing as part of the Windows Azure accreditation by the UK government. And that pen test report is available to customers under NDA. So you can look at, this is by the way, a Crest and Check certified security testing company, very reputable. And so you can actually take a look at that test. But most importantly, you can pen test your own applications deployed to Windows Azure. And I'll talk more about that. Customers are oftentimes very concerned about insight into Windows Azure. So what do we have in terms of intrusion detection, monitoring, logging? How do we know that there are active attacks going on at the platform level? I'll talk more about application level or what you as a customer can do. But we've built a custom system that's called Microsoft Monitoring and Diagnostic Service, MDS. So Monitoring and Diagnostic Service is what we have in place to essentially aggregate monitoring data collected by monitoring agent on every node throughout Windows Azure and store that vast amount of data. We're talking about hundreds of terabytes of data, and store that in a centralized MDS repository. So it's a central correlation analysis aggregation system that we have, and then we built proprietary front-end tools to essentially do real-time alerting on this abnormal log data that's collected in MDS. So we monitor for a wide range of security events such as creation of unauthorized local users and local groups and changes to drivers and services and IP configurations and so forth. There's a whole suite of events that we capture as part of the monitoring infrastructure and put into MDS. And then component teams such as Dev, Fabric, Storage, and others, they're responsible for deciding which events to capture and which alerts they need to have in place. And so one of the systems that we built to front-end MDS is called Alerts and Incident Management System, or AIMS. And that system will generate essentially real-time emails or alarms in response to events that are captured relative to the baseline specified by component teams. We also built another tool that's called Early Warning System that is used to monitor for typical anti-malware or malware virus type of activity in the platform. We also, by the way, do full virus scans on all builds before deploying Windows Azure code into production. And so only the code that has a clean scan using Microsoft Forefront Endpoint Protection Antivirus Tool will be actually deployed. At the underlying infrastructure layer, GFS does have more formalized hardware-based NIDs and system that they use to track intrusion detection, and they also have a 24/7 team that responds to these, you know, external attacks. So customers oftentimes ask me, well, but tell me, what kind of assurances do you provide that you will notify me in case something happens? And we actually do give contractual assurances around security incident management and breach notifications. So we promise to you that we will notify you promptly in case of a security incident involving your data, that we will then work with you on analyzing the security incident and mitigating the effects and so forth. So you'll find more information about that in our legal paper. So if you happen to be an Azure customer, you'll get that information in a contract. So let's talk a little bit about identity and access. So there is a whole lot of information out there on the topic of identity and access when it comes to the end users, such as Windows Azure Active Directory. And there are other sessions at the conference that you can attend to learn more about the developments in this space, especially around the integration of Azure Management Portal with federated, so integration of AD, Windows Azure AD with on-premises corporate identities, ability to federate identities, and so forth. So we'll not really spend time on that. What I want to tell you about is what happens under the covers in Windows Azure when it comes to data access. This is a great concern to many customers. And so customers oftentimes ask me, well, what prevents someone from deleting my data? Or how do I know that Windows Azure admins cannot get into my VMs or storage accounts at will and then snoop around and find out what I have, you know, where my stuff is? So that's what this topic is about. And there is a difference in the approach. So if you use infrastructure as a service, we really cannot get into your VMs, period. There's just simply no way. But we also cannot offer you much assistance when it comes to, you know, troubleshooting what you did there. But with the PaaS approach, so if you're using cloud services, there are instances where a customer will specifically call Windows Azure support, create a ticket, open a ticket with support, and request assistance. A customer will say, yes, Microsoft, I want you to go into my virtual machine, and I want you to tell me what's wrong, because I cannot figure it out. And the reason why we have this process in place is because the Windows Azure PaaS VMs are based on they're based on Windows Server code base, but it's a stripped down version of Windows Server that we don't make available to you, and it runs on an even more stripped down and hardened hypervisor that we also don't make available to you. So you cannot snapshot these VMs, you cannot run them on premises. So that's why it's important for us to have the ability to troubleshoot in case you request it. So by default, it is not possible for Windows Azure admin personnel to get into customer VMs or customer storage accounts, period. It's not possible by default for IaaS and PaaS equally. There are no local user accounts on customer VMs, and the default Windows admin account is disabled. You cannot get into a VM without first creating a local account and then using RDP login to get in. So customers should always monitor their virtual machines and storage accounts. If anyone creates a local account and RDPs into that account, these are security events that customers can harvest from their own logs, and they can filter them based on IP address. They will know who, when, from what place try to get in. And we recommend highly that customers do that. But nonetheless, in case there is a request for a Windows Azure admin to get into a customer virtual machine for troubleshooting purposes, for instance, that process is highly restricted. And that's what I'd like to tell you more about. That process is described in our ISO audit report and also in our SOC 1 Type 2 audit report. So you can find third-party auditor's opinion on the process. So the way that access works is that access to Azure is possible only via jump boxes. Jump boxes are servers with dual NICs. One connects to Azure Microsoft corporate domain, the other connects to the Windows Azure domain. You can get onto a jump box only if you're authorized and only if you only if you go through a two-factor authentication. So it's based on a valid corporate credential and a smart card with a valid certificate. Once in the jump box, you can get access to the fabric to get into the customer VMs only if you were given a temporary account for that purpose, normally for about 6 hours, and only after the entire incident is fully logged and entered into our TFS system with specific approval from a Windows Azure GM. So we have to be able to provide a full audit trail of these types of activities, and because we have that in place, we have been able to actually offer something like a HIPAA business associate agreement, because we have well-documented process on tracking access to data. So by default, it isn't possible to get in. On special occasions, it can be done, but it's a highly restricted process. Let's talk a little bit about the host. On every Azure node, there is a hypervisor that's layered directly over the hardware. That hypervisor is based on Windows Hyper-V technology, but it's actually quite a bit stripped down and hardened compared to the Hyper-V. Nonetheless, on top of the hypervisor, there can be arbitrary number of guest virtual machines, one or more. And then there is one special virtual machine called the root VM that runs host OS. So there is a Windows firewall on every guest virtual machine. There is also a firewall on the host, on the root virtual machine. The only ports open and addressable in the Windows firewall on the guest VM are those defined explicitly by customer in the service definition file. So we recommend that you not open ports that are not needed. If you create a public IP on your VM, then your VM is going to be visible from the outside world, and you know the ports that you open will also be accessible to others. So that's just a common sense approach. We make sure that all traffic, and by the way, this type of diagram is equally valid for IaaS VMs as well. Infrastructure service virtual machines, the VHD files for those VMs are stored in Azure Blob Storage. So the security controls and processes that we have in place are equally applicable to the PaaS VM as well as IaaS VMs, because the underlying storage is the same. So I'll talk more about that. But before we will grant access to network and disk, the traffic has to be filtered through the hypervisor and the root VM, and that's where the packet filtering I mentioned earlier gets applied. These filters are configured by the fabric controllers through the fabric agents, which are deployed on Azure VMs. And so an important point I'd like to mention that's oftentimes overlooked for someone who's coming from a traditional on-premises infrastructure or a traditional hosting provider infrastructure. Provisioning of Azure virtual machines, and I'm talking specifically about PaaS VMs now, is very, very different. So when you provision a PaaS VM, what happens is that the image for that virtual machine gets copied from the known good build, the location that's controlled and known only to Microsoft. Every single line of source code in those VMs is controlled by Microsoft. It is not possible to provision a virtual machine in some incomplete or unpatched state. When we patch VMs, we don't patch them the way a hosting provider would do that. So essentially, all we do is we take the VM down, we reboot the VM. When the VM boots, it's guaranteed to boot into the known good image and it's guaranteed to have the patch applied. So traditional vulnerability scanning techniques are not as applicable to Windows Azure, because across, say, 500,000 virtual machines, when you are scanning them, you have only 3 or 4 different configurations. You'll be scanning over and over again for the same configuration. So our philosophy is a little bit different. So we essentially have a central policy that we enforce, and we do not permit any local variations. So the patching of these VMs is our responsibility, and deployment of these VMs is our responsibility. So it's a kind of very automated process. Also, the patching does not violate the SLA we have with you in place. So the way Windows Azure is designed is to accommodate these rolling patches where we can take VMs down and patch them without affecting your application. With IaaS, the situation is different. In this case, you can either provision a virtual machine from a gallery of images using Windows or Linux-based VMs. You can bring in your own using a VHD file format. But when you do so, you're also responsible for patching and managing these virtual machines. We do have a public track record on MSDN where we disclose all the patches for the guest VMs, including what patch was applied, when, what security vulnerabilities were addressed in that patch, and so forth. Another interesting point is about support lifecycle. You probably all know about the support policy we have in place for box products, the 5 years plus 5 years support lifecycle. Now, that had to be changed in the world of online services. And so what we did with online services support lifecycle policy, we came up with the term of a disruptive change. And that disruptive change means that the change that we would make to the platform would cause you, in turn, to have to make significant changes to your end user application, significant admin work, and so forth. And so if you read up on this policy, you'll find that we guarantee that we'll give you a 12-month advance notice before making a disruptive change to the platform. I forgot to mention that you can opt out of automated patching for the PaaS VMs if you choose to do so, although I wouldn't recommend it. So let's talk about what's probably of great interest to you. So what happens with your application? So what can you do for DDoS protection, intrusion detection, and so forth? There is a white paper that we are currently revising and will be soon republished called Security Best Practices for Developing Windows Azure Applications. It's a set of best practices, and we will update it to cover some of the IaaS developments and so forth. But it's a really good white paper to either study on your own or give to your developers to help them build more secure Windows Azure applications. An important point I need to make is that Windows Azure does not inspect, monitor, or approve your applications. We really have no idea how you design the app or what your app does or what a typical traffic pattern or a normal traffic pattern for your application looks like. We also don't know what kind of data you choose to store in Windows Azure. Some data could be more important to you and some data could be less important to you. To us, it's all the same. The data of the same importance. We have no way of knowing what that data is getting into your storage accounts. So this is important to know, because sometimes when I have discussions with customers, they will ask me, so why don't you protect my particular application XYZ deployed as part of my subscription? Here's my subscription ID. And the thing is, we really have many, many customers in Windows Azure, and they have many, many applications deployed in Windows Azure. It is not possible for us to monitor your individual applications and tell you, hey, something funky is going on. We do have, as part of the platform services monitoring, we have means to detect suspicious activity, such as repeated login attempts, for instance, or evidence of DDoS attacks. So we will act on those. We will obviously always act if you escalate an issue to us and say, hey, I think I'm being under attack, or I'm being attacked by another Azure tenant, or and so forth, and we will help you there. So there is a CTP currently available for anti-malware protection for PaaS VMs. The reason why it's trickier to do that for PaaS VMs than for IaaS is, with IaaS you can deploy whatever the tool of your choice into your virtual machine image. But with PaaS VMs, you have to make sure that what you deploy becomes part of the deployment package. So whenever that VM spins up, that the package goes along with it, and the antivirus engine gets deployed, and it pulls the latest antivirus signature and so forth. So we have that CTP in place. It's done by the forefront, by the endpoint protection team. And we're also actively looking into this, you know, how to make that whole experience more user-friendly for you, so that it's not so dev-centric as it is today, but more of a kind of a management exercise from the Azure portal, where you would go in and, you know, essentially say, I want protection enabled on this VM. I want to scan my storage accounts and scan these files and so forth. So that's currently actively underway. So let's talk a bit about DDoS protection. I mentioned earlier that we have active DDoS protection for the platform services that will sanitize all of the incoming TCP and UDP traffic. And you as a tenant do benefit from that. But it's still possible for you to be targeted using a variety of different types of attacks when you are in Windows Azure, especially if you have a application that's accessible from the web. So we have a very good page called Windows Azure Diagnostics that gives you a lot of guidance on how to monitor your virtual machines as well as your storage accounts, and really kind of collect information about external attacks on your virtual machine. If you think you're under attack, based on your monitoring insight, you can call Azure support and say, I am under attack, help me out. And we have teams that are trained to act properly to these types of requests, and they will assist you. You can also do something to protect yourself. You can build your application to filter incoming traffic. You can lock down your application and not open ports that are not needed. You can also deploy a third-party IDS or a web application firewall, such as Barracuda, into a VM and protect your guest OS. So Barracuda recently announced at the RSA conference, I believe it was in February, that they released a web application firewall for Windows Azure that you can use to guard against a whole variety of web protocol attacks, such as cross-site scripting and SQL injection attacks and RDP hacking and so forth. So it would be good to follow up with Barracuda perhaps and find out, you know, what they offer. I really haven't had time to look into it, but I think it's an interesting offer. And there'll be more of them, more similar offers coming from other vendors. I get oftentimes asked about disaster recovery and business continuity. So customers want to know, well, how do I know that if your data center goes down, that my application will not be affected? I'll talk more about how we store data and what provisions we have in place to make sure that your data is always available. But let me just say that today, on that Trust Center, you'll find a really good white paper called Business Continuity for Windows Azure. And so we today do not offer a DR, disaster recovery-based SLA, service level agreement. However, we do offer you all the technologies needed for you to design an application that meets your own RPO and RTO metrics defined by your business. So recovery point objective and recovery time objective. Customers will ask me, well, what RPO or what RTO can you guarantee? That's going to be really up to you how you design the application. If you want the app to never go down, you can certainly do that. You can build an active setup using two geo-replicated instances of your service, and your app will always be up and running. A good example I'd like to mention is Amazon also doesn't offer a DR-based SLA. Netflix is a well-known customer of Amazon. So when Amazon's entire region went down, Netflix wasn't affected. So that's because they realized, here's what we need to do to build a service that's going to be resilient to these types of failures, and they did it. So by going to the cloud does not mean that you can forget about building distributed applications properly. All of the techniques you have adopted so far for your on-premises application will apply equally well in the cloud. There is a question that I get asked oftentimes, well, what if there's a forensic investigation? How will Microsoft assist me with furnishing data that's needed for the investigation? So if you as a customer are involved in a legal case and you need access to platform level logs to uncover, you know, what happened in the course of an incident investigation, we will help you with that request. We will provide you with platform level logs that are sanitized and apply only to your account. You don't have to do anything special like make a formal request, we will do that. What we cannot do is we cannot give you platform level logs that pertain to another customer. If you need, in the course of a forensic investigation, if you need that kind of information, you will need to provide us with a valid court order or a valid subpoena signed by a judge, because we cannot disclose customer data without that court order. We'll talk more about that. Let me talk about data. Interestingly, it turns out that most of our customers are very interested about data deletion and destruction. So that's kind of a very hot topic, what happens when data gets deleted. But let me also tell you just quickly how your data gets committed to storage, because that's also important before I talk about data deletion and destruction. So when you put data into Windows Azure storage, such as Blob or, you know, table storage, what happens is that we have a locally redundant storage. That means your data is kept in triplicate, is kept across three physically separate fault domains with different top of rack switches, so that if one part of the hardware infrastructure goes down, the fabric controller will sense that one of your replicas is missing and will then provision another copy of your data, so that at any given time, there are always going to be three copies of your data at the primary location. We also pair our data centers. So Chicago is paired with San Antonio, and Virginia is paired with California. So we will also do something else. Unless you choose to disable this feature, we will also geo-replicate your data. So we'll take, essentially asynchronously, we will take your data from your primary location and copy it to the secondary site that's at least 400 miles away, and we'll keep it in triplicate at the secondary location as well. So at any given time, you will have six copies of your data in two physically separate facilities at least 400 miles apart. The purpose is to make sure that if, for instance, Chicago were to be blown away or severely damaged, you still wouldn't lose your data. But it's important to recognize this setup is for us to ensure data durability in case of major disasters. This isn't an active setup. You cannot count on geo-replication to give you instant failover. This is primarily for Microsoft to flip the switch manually in case we realize that there's significant damage in the storage service in a particular region, that it would take longer to repair it than to flip over and move everyone to the secondary facility. So it's not a service that we offer to you, and it's also not a service available per individual customer. So when you design your distributed app, you have to take this into consideration. If you want that app to run no matter what, then you can make it an active and use geo-replicate data for that purpose. Storage works really simply. A customer or a given Azure subscription can have many storage accounts, and each account is protected by a set of storage account keys. When you provision storage in Windows Azure Management Portal, you get issued two keys. These are randomly generated 512-bit keys. And we give you two so you can actually support key rollover, which is a good practice. You can regenerate these keys at any given time. These keys safeguard access to your storage. The Fabric controller will challenge every access to storage with a request for the key. Whoever has the key has access to storage. If you internally have lax processes and you compromise the keys, then your storage can be accessible over the internet. And so if the keys are compromised, that could be a problem. Data backup. Windows Azure performs backup on an ongoing basis for things that we control, such as platform certs and keys, last known good build, also things like deployment packages or DNS records and so forth. However, we do not back up your data. You need to use our documented APIs if you need to create an offsite copy of your data to essentially guard against things like accidental deletes or problems with your software and so forth. So you can do that on your own. There is a bit of a confusion here because there is a service called Windows Azure Backup, but it's meant to give you a backup service for your on-premises Windows infrastructure. It's not an Azure backup for your Azure data. Windows Azure does not have a backup service, and we also don't have, sometimes they get asked, do we have archival storage with guaranteed data immutability? So there is, we don't have such a service in place today. And now we come to this topic of data deletion, and I get asked questions a lot from customers as well. What prevents a Windows Azure admin from just deleting my data? And I get completely, you know, out of luck and stuck. Or what happens if I delete my data? How can you guarantee that no other customer can read my deleted data? So, you know, questions of that type. So let's talk a little bit about that. So when you delete a blob or a table entity, we will immediately delete that entry from the index that's used to hold, to locate and access your data at the primary location. And then we will asynchronously delete your data from the geo-replicated copy. You as a customer can then verify yourself. You can go and try to look up that blob or table entity, and you will not find it in the index because we have very strong consistency on data deletes. It's important to realize that Windows Azure customers never have access to raw storage, and before any storage can be made available to customers, before storage can be provisioned, it has to be overwritten. Now, there is a really good blog post by Walter Myers and Charlie Kaufman that talks about data deletion and destruction, very detailed and highly recommended. You will find out that data in Azure is, you know, allocated, or disks are allocated sparsely. What that means is that when you create a virtual disk, the underlying space on the physical area, the physical storage, is not allocated for its entire capacity. Instead, all that happens is that when you create a virtual disk, we create a table that maps addresses from your virtual disk to the areas on the physical disk where the data eventually gets stored, and that table is initially empty. The very first time you write to the virtual disk, we essentially allocate required space on the physical side and then place a pointer into that table. So if someone, if anyone tries to then read or access regions on a virtual disk that they have not previously written to, the physical space would not have been allocated to correspond to the virtual disk, and only zeros would be returned. So it's not possible for someone else to read your deleted data. They can only read data that they have previously written to. So even though we don't give you a contractual guarantee that says we will overwrite your deleted data within 30 or 60 or however many days, we do make it impossible for anyone to provision data that hasn't been overwritten, and we make it impossible for anyone to read data that you deleted. So that's an important clarification. We also have a process in place to destroy, like physically destroy, hard drives that are no longer functioning. So our process follows NIST SP800-88, and so we will use a clear and purge process that's comprised of seven-pass wipe plus verify to wipe the hard drives. And those drives that cannot spin, we will typically shred them or pulverize them so they get physically destroyed, and we'll retain records of the destruction. Customers want to know that once the physical hard drives leave the premises, they need to be destroyed so that no one can access their data. There is a bit of a misconception here, because data in Azure is kind of pulled into a single pool from many customers, and it's very transient. So you cannot really walk up into an Azure storage rack somewhere in Chicago facility and walk up and put your finger onto a hard drive and say, well, here's where my data is, because the fabric will move your data as it sees fit, and your data is going to be mixed with other customers' data, and maybe a sliver of your data will be on that physical hard drive on a given day, but maybe not on another day. So it's not as easy to kind of pinpoint that. There are lots of questions around data encryption. So I wrote a document on the Trust Center under the HIPAA compliance section that's called HIPAA Implementation Guidance, and you'll find encryptions for data at rest and in transit in that document. But the options differ based on whether you choose to use infrastructure as a service or platform as a service. So if you choose infrastructure as a service, then you actually get to benefit from very decent and you know, validated encryption at rest that SQL Server offers. So SQL Server database has transparent data encryption at rest, also a key management service. So what this means is that data is encrypted automatically as it's being written to disk without you having to do much of anything, but yet data is actually searchable, indexable, and available to your applications. You can also use encrypting file system in Windows Server. Data in transit, you can encrypt that by configuring SSL traffic between your client application and your service and so forth. For the platform as a service offering, there is currently no automated data encryption at rest. So if you put data into SQL database, Windows Azure SQL database, or if you put data into Windows Azure storage, you cannot, you know, change a flag and say, now I want my data to be encrypted. You will need to use our crypto API or another crypto provider to encrypt your data prior to uploading data into Windows Azure, and you will need to manage keys off premises. In this case, no one can ever touch your data. So that's not as convenient as what you get with IaaS, because once encrypted off platform and put into Azure storage, that data is really not very useful to you. But that is an option. We used to have a lab called Trust Services, where we maintained trust servers in the cloud and allowed you to kind of do very nice automated key management and access to your encrypted data. That lab was, and that was applicable for both Azure Storage as well as Windows Azure SQL Database. That lab was completed in November, and the learnings from that lab, as well as customer scenarios, are now being rolled into a commercial offering. I don't have a timeline to share, but it's something that we're actively working on to give you better options for data encryption at rest. In transit for PaaS, we, in that document I mentioned, you will see that we tell you how to configure HTTPS endpoints, so that's not a problem. Access to your storage, by the way, is possible over both HTTP and HTTPS. So if you are accessing storage over public internet, you should use HTTPS. Just to mention briefly, we are one of the few major public cloud service providers that has a cloud-specific privacy statement, where we tell you exactly what we do with your data, that we do not use your data for any other purpose but to offer you the Windows Azure service, that we don't mine your data, we don't use it to sell you something else, we don't use it for search and advertising or online retailing, none of that stuff. So it is a very good, solid privacy policy that I think is unique in this space. And I oftentimes get asked the question, well, you know, if I choose my data to be in Europe, can you guarantee Microsoft that my data will never leave Europe? And so the answer is yes. We actually give you that guarantee on the trust center. We'll also give you the guarantee in the data processing agreement, which is a contractual addendum that we offer to customers. So we will guarantee that the data will never get moved from the chosen geographic region. When you put your data into Dublin, if you enable geo-replication, we will geo-replicate to Amsterdam, but we will not move your data to Hong Kong, and we will not move your data to United States. And the same is true for other regions. Now, that's important because some customers are very concerned about the geolocation of their data. Now, the second question is, well, but what if I ask you to help me troubleshoot an issue that I have in Windows Azure? What happens then? So we will still never move your data, but because our support infrastructure runs 24/7 and it has this follow the sun type of principle where you have teams in Redmond, in Ireland, in China, all over the globe, it is possible that your request will be processed by a team that's based in some other region. So if you are a European customer, we will not guarantee to you that the team in Ireland will handle your request. It's very possible that your troubleshooting ticket will be processed by a developer in Redmond. So that dev in Redmond may take a look at the platform logs or other types of data that are important for him to troubleshoot the issue. So even though the data would not physically be moved, it is possible for data to be touched or investigated by someone who is based outside of the European region. And I think that's just kind of common sense, but it's not all that well understood. We are building and deploying new facilities all the time, so we intend to cover more regions, but we will never have a data center in every country. So some European countries have told me, but we must have an Azure data center in our country. And if we were to do that, it would kind of negate the whole principle of public cloud and scale and efficiency that we have in infrastructure. Now, to help customers gain insight into these controls and processes we have in place, we embarked on a comprehensive compliance program. And we realized that oftentimes we were being essentially asked to evaluate really the same controls over and over again as part of different audits. And so we put in Windows Azure a master control framework that allows us to target ISO and SSA 16 and FedRAMP or the underlying NIST foundation, pretty much any type of compliance framework. And we now have the ability to actually go through our audits fairly efficiently with third-party auditors. We are influenced by what you tell us is needed. So if you think that, hey, we are really blocked on the lack of this particular compliance program, it'd be great if Azure had X, Y, or Z. We will take that input and we will then analyze what it would take for us to actually deliver on that compliance program. And we'll put customer requirements through this compliance framework. And in the end, we deliver various types of certs and attestations. So here's what we have in place for Windows Azure. And if you go to the Trust Center, as I said, I maintain that site. I'm being very transparent regarding what's in scope for different compliance programs, because not all Azure features are in scope for all of these compliance programs. We have a very broad footprint and we have very bold ambitions, and we want to advance the entire platform through these compliance programs, but it'll take us some time to get there, but we definitely want to do that. So we have ISO 27001, we have SSA 16, also known as SOC 1. We do a type 2 audit where we essentially will have the auditor, in our case it's Deloitte, they'll monitor a chosen control set over a 6-month period, and then they'll render, provide an opinion on how effective the controls were in achieving the stated control objective during that monitoring period. So much different than a simple type 1 audit where you just enumerate controls and say, here's what's in place, but you don't actually, you know, stay there to observe a password change or a network device and so forth. We are in process for a SOC 2 type 2 audit, so the monitoring has been completed. We're in the process of working with the auditor to assemble the audit report. We have a STAR submission, submission to the Cloud Security Alliance STAR registry, so you can download the white paper from our security page on the Trust Center. We are one of the only major public cloud providers willing to sign EU model clauses. These are additional guarantees that we offer to customers that go beyond the safe harbor framework that we as a corporation attest to. Some of our European customers consider safe harbor to be just weak for safeguarding of personal data that originates in the EU, and we will offer model clauses to those customers. We're also probably the only major public cloud service provider that's created by the UK government for impact level 2 data. We are also one of very few cloud vendors willing to sign a HIPAA business associate agreement. So if you're building a healthcare application on Windows Azure, you will need this agreement. And we will give you the agreement to make sure that we have actually evaluated a lengthy list of HIPAA controls, and we made sure that we can meet HIPAA requirements, and we have the proper processes in place to deal with breach notifications, you know, protection, safeguarding of your data, and so forth. And we're currently in process for the FISMA and FedRAMP authorization. FISMA, FedRAMP is the new streamlined process. It's probably the most complex and time-consuming and expensive audit that a cloud vendor can go through. I show on this slide as FISMA encompassing pretty much all of the other audits by virtue of the underlying NIST 800-53 framework. So that's currently underway, and I don't have a timeline. It's kind of, we're awaiting their decision, but we are very much in the process. And the scope is going to be enlarged relative to other scopes we have for other programs. So I think I may have used almost all the time. So back to the Trust Center, please visit this page. I'd love to, maybe you can stay longer after the session, but I'd love to really hear from you about what you have come to uncover as the biggest security blockers for cloud adoption, or if you have any feedback or questions about this topic, I'd love to hear that. PCI isn't, so the question was, is payment card industry data security standard on the list? I don't think there are issues for us to go through that audit, except that the team is really busy with all of this. And if you talk to our Azure compliance engineering team, they'll tell you it's really, the schedule is very booked. So underlying controls that we need to have in place are part of our master framework, so that's not a problem. We just need to schedule an audit with a QSA, a qualified security assessor, go through the PCI DSS validation. If you were to build an application where credit card data is stored in Windows Azure or somehow or otherwise transacted or accessed in Azure, if you are building a typical online commerce application where you need to essentially process a credit card payment through a secure iframe or redirect to PayPal or other service, you can do that today. We will give you the report to compliance or ROC or ROC that we have for the underlying physical infrastructure. And then when you design the app, you want to make sure that you capture the primary account number and other credit card data in that iframe, and that gets channeled to physically separate infrastructure. So Azure really would not be in scope. However, if you are the kind of customer who doesn't want to use the iframe because it will degrade your user experience or, you know, affect the design of your application, or you just want Azure to be the sole backend through which you want to send credit card data to be processed by some other payment gateway, will need to give you Azure validation. Or if you happen to be a customer that's actually in the business of credit card payments, like a major payment processing company, then you also need Azure to be validated. So we're going to work on that this calendar year. So I know that security is probably the biggest blocker for not just Azure adoption, but cloud adoption, period. What my job is to find out what specifically the blockers are. So I can conduct, you know, go to 10, a dozen or so different studies that we conducted as well as third-party research, and they will all tell me the same thing. It is the biggest blocker. What I want to learn really is kind of once you peel the onion, what specifically the blockers are, so we have some actionable items for Azure engineering. And that's what I've been doing as a planner for the Azure security team, kind of uncovering these key blocking points for Azure adoption that are security-centric. So I've told you about some of the things I've learned over the past 2 years. My email is stevevi@microsoft.com. So if you have any questions or comments, by all means, let me know. All right, thank you.